Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live alternate Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tonight's show, February 27th, 2013, is a very exciting one for me to bring to all of you, and a bit of a miracle that it's happening given the weather. We've had yet another night and day of icy driving, but here I am, and here we all will be. The title of the show is Surviving and Thriving After Trauma with a Partner's Support. My guest and co-host is Michelle Rosenthal, a keynote speaker, award-winning blogger, author, workshop seminar leader, certified professional coach, and mental health advocate. Michelle works privately as a post-trauma coach specializing in post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. She's the host of Your Life After Trauma on Contact Talk Radio, and she's also the founder of HealMyPTSD.com, a very popular website for information, education, and support for PTSD. Her trauma PTSD recovery book, Before the World Intruded, was recently announced as a finalist for the Books for a Better Life Award. I have begun to read it, and I will tell you all, it is a fantastic read. It is totally relevant and will be totally, I think it will hit home in a way that's very, very meaningful, particularly for anybody who's been through trauma. Anyway, welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here, and I'm so glad you got home safely.
Yeah, that was what probably what you would call trauma with a little T. You
know,
getting through weather like that where you're not really sure if you're going to end up in a ditch, but you think at this point I'd be a veteran of it, but it never quite leaves you. I've had two total wrecks in the winter, but here we are. Anyway, I'm very excited to have you here, and I've actually been, you know, as I mentioned to our listeners, I've been reading your book, and it's just absolutely wonderful. And that's just your book. As you know, I explained in your bio, you're doing all kinds of things. So I very much look forward to talking about this topic. And I just wanted to start first by mentioning to callers that anyone calling in, your toll-free number is 877-497-9046. And if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, just dial 1 on your phone and you'll be in line to join us on the air. And I'm wondering, Michelle, my thought is taking questions and comments at intervals. How does that sound to you so we don't save it all to the end?
I think that sounds great. That way every topic that we talk about can be followed up with a question that's appropriate for right where we are. That sounds great.
Okay, good. I think it'll be easier for people because when people try to hold on to a question, they often forget, and then we're into another topic, and it can get lost. I wanted to start by asking you, you're a trauma specialist. It's what you do, and you're really immersed in this world. You're kind of an authority on the subject. And for our listeners, I'm wondering if you could start by describing how you would define trauma.
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to start because I think that there are two types of trauma, and understanding the difference for our conversation and just in general is so helpful in conceptualizing how we heal. So I see it as being we have little T trauma and big T trauma. And little T trauma are those stressors that are short-lived but they make your life much more dramatic, even sometimes melodramatic, than usual. And I write about this in Before the World Intruded, the difference in the language and the semantics of what trauma means. For example, this is how I describe it in the book. I had a friend who was, you know, she was in an uncomfortable position, caught between her boyfriend and his ex-girlfriend, and she said to me, "I was so traumatized." And really, she meant she was embarrassed. And we use the word traumatized a lot when we mean something else. And it's really just, we're indicating it was a big deal to us.
Mm-hmm.
And then with big T trauma, we have really what becomes a life-threatening emotional or physical harm, impending danger, something that we survive that's so extraordinarily dangerous to us that it leaves an enormous traumatic impression. And so I think that when we talk about trauma, little t trauma is valid. So we're not discounting it. We're just separating the little t traumas of daily living from the big T trauma of the shock and surprise of some life-threatening circumstance.
Okay, so they obviously both have an impact that feels really jarring, but I would imagine the long-term impact of the big T is very different than the long-term impact of the little T. And the work, I would imagine, around the big T trauma is different than the little T trauma.
Absolutely. I think there's very little work around little t trauma usually, because it's like a bump in the road and we usually move through it. And while it feels intense at the time, our minds and our bodies usually process themselves over a period of time, but we don't usually see many major symptoms come from that. Whereas
right.
with big T trauma, we've got, you know, a whole pathology of symptoms.
Okay, so my singing to myself in the car on the way home, Amazing Grace, praying I was going to get home in one piece and not miss the show and not be able to contact you, would have been a little T. And it sounds like it's a perfect example of something that's transient, something that feels very intense and threatening, but it doesn't stay with you. It doesn't imprint on you in the same way. I still will get in the car and I'll kind of, it'll be there as a little mini memory, but it's not going to affect my ability to drive or anything like that.
That's a great example. You're not going to go to bed tonight and have nightmares. You're not going to wake up in a cold sweat screaming. You're not going to tomorrow feel so on edge that if somebody comes within 3 feet of you, you're jumping out of your skin. So that's a great example. You're absolutely right. The brain is really good at processing shocks and surprises to degrees, you know? So you go through a stressor like driving through bad weather, and it's really stressful, and then maybe it takes you the rest of the night to unwind. But when you wake up tomorrow morning, it's business as usual.
Okay. My experience as a therapist is that often people feel apologetic about the little t traumas and referring to them as traumatizing. They're afraid they're going to be experienced as kind of melodramatic or histrionic, when in fact it's been something that's been very upsetting and jarring. And often people feel a little defensive about it because, well, I wasn't raped, I wasn't mugged, there was no home invasion. Am I entitled to have even a momentary experience of intense upset? And I think it's great that you're saying that there are different levels, and they each have a different kind of impact, but you would characterize them each as traumatic in a way.
And I think, yes, to build on what you're saying, is they're both valid. Whatever you feel to whatever degree of intensity is valid, and you don't have to apologize for you in that moment. For whatever reason, it seemed enormous. And I think that that's, you know, we're all human, and we have our days when we can handle things better than others, and we have things that make us feel out of control and unfamiliar, and that's frightening. And all of us have different levels to which we can absorb that feeling and still function. And,
okay.
And I think that no matter what you feel, it's valid. The question is, what are you going to do to move through it? And you don't
yes.
have to apologize to anybody for needing to do that process.
Right, right. And that's where we get into the meat of our show. How do you move through it and how do you overcome it so it doesn't define you? You don't feel like you're identified in an ongoing way as a victim. Now, Michelle, I'm wondering, I know in just beginning to read your book, I learned a lot of things about you, and I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners and our callers, and we have several of them already, which is wonderful, just so that they understand where you are coming from, what happened to you that was traumatic, and how was your life affected by the trauma? And then if we could talk about what some of the biggest challenges were for you around this trauma.
Oh, absolutely. So let's start at the very beginning, which means we're going back to 1981. I was a 13-year-old kid in a fantastic family, idyllic childhood, and I had an allergic reaction to a medication that is so rare, none of my doctors had ever seen it. Essentially, this medication turned me into a full-body third-degree burn patient almost literally overnight. And, of course, I was hospitalized, and by the time I came out of the hospital weeks later, I knew I was going on to make a full physical recovery. I had some scarring, but nothing that would alter my life physically. Emotionally, I just was not that resilient. While I had lost 100% of my epidermis in the hospital, I came out and had lost 100% of myself. And that was harder to get back than any of the physical things that I'd been dealing with. And back at that time, post-traumatic stress disorder was a very new diagnosis. While it's been around for centuries, it became a clinical diagnosis in 1980, so that was just the year prior to my illness. And it grew out of the support groups for Vietnam veterans. So nobody was looking at a civilian kid with a medical trauma as a PTSD candidate. And in fact, when my parents tried to get me to talk to anybody or have a psychiatric evaluation, I just flat out lied and faked my way through it, telling everybody I was fine, hiding the fact that I was suddenly a horrible insomniac and I had a recurring nightmare that someone was trying to kill me, and started moving through my life very aware that I was no longer the person I had been before this happened. I was terrified. I was anxious. I was very aware in Before the World Intruded, in my book, that title comes from the fact that I kept trying to go back to who I'd been before the world intruded. I wanted to go back to that girl, and I kept trying to impersonate her. And, you know, the fact is you can't go back, and I did not learn that for a very long time. So while I kept trying, the PTSD symptoms began to become very pronounced. But at that time, I was a teenager, and so everybody said, well, she's a difficult teenager. And I've always been a writer since I was 7, and I became a writer professionally as I grew older. And so everybody said, well, she's a temperamental artist. And, you know, Susan, in myself, I thought, you know, I am an artist, and some people are just meant to be crazy. Lots of artists are crazy, and I'm just one of those crazy people. And I accepted that I had really an enormous amount of rage that just spewed on anybody who crossed my path, most frequently my mother, unfortunately. I apologize to her all the time now. In addition to what we see as major PTSD symptoms in three categories, arousal, re-experiencing, and avoidance, meaning arousal, you are always on the edge thinking that danger is around the corner and you have to keep yourself safe, and exaggerated startle response is a perfect example of that. And re-experiencing, constantly having to shove down the memories and program myself, don't think about that, don't go back there, don't let yourself go back there, which means pushing down every thought that keeps coming. And then the nightmares, and then avoidance, you know, this I can't talk about it, I can't think about it. If I have to go to a doctor, I am a quivering mass of jello. I can't speak, I can barely breathe. So it's avoiding all the things that are following you and moving through a life in a fog. You know, so many survivors talk about the PTSD fog, and I think it's something that we all experience. You spend all of your energy coping inside just to get through the next 5 minutes, and it doesn't leave you with a whole lot of energy, for example, to develop a career that's stable or develop relationships that are stable or family systems that work. And so all of these things were a major problem for me, in addition to the fact that I ended up developing an eating disorder, because really all we want after PTSD and after a trauma is safety and control. And so that was one of the ways that I decided to control this body that I was terrified to have to live in, because I felt every day somebody could make a mistake, and they had told me, you will not survive if this happens again. You barely survived this time. So walking around knowing that your body can betray you in any moment was very difficult, and it really colored the way that I lived. And you know, decades of that really twist you up.
It sounds like a complete loss of innocence, that earlier you were just a young adolescent going through life, and then all of a sudden you're thrown into this realm of understanding about how it's not a given that you're going to be okay or that people are going to be able to help. And unfortunately for you, at a time when there was not the language around PTSD, sounds like it was really limited in terms of diagnosis and understanding about what to do with it. So it sounds like it was pretty horrific. You go into it in very clear detail in the book. You really make that come alive about how that can happen. Now, Michelle, we have one person who's had a question for a while. Would you like to take a question at this point?
Absolutely.
Okay, let me bring this person on the air. Hello, area code 520. Can you say what your name is and share your question or comment?
Yeah, this is Brandy.
Okay. And what's your question or your comment?
My question is this. Can a big T turn into a little T? Like, if you've been through trauma, for example, I moved away from my family for 21 years, and I'm coming back, but I'm living in the same house, now renting the same place from my parents. And in this place, in my parents' house, I witnessed a murder when I was 13. But this was the only place to come back to, you know, if I were to move home. So I noticed that when I first got here, I hadn't seen the house remodeled, you know, for, it happened in, I think, 87, 88, something like that. So I hadn't seen the remodel. I got in here, I explored, I put my stuff kind of where I wanted it for, I've been now in the house for 3.5 weeks. And I look around, and all I keep picturing is, like, the staircase where it used to be. But I'm not reliving the whole, you know, murder out the window, you know, where the window still is. But I'm not going through that. Now, when I happen to come across the man's wife, the murder victim's wife, and she's also 21 years older, she remembers me as a kid, and I remember her from that horrific night. And I looked at her, and I didn't feel that, like, major trauma like I thought I was, but I had a lot of anxiety leading up to what if I ran into these people. So my question is, I know I had a very traumatic childhood before that even happened, but does that mean I've healed enough to only have a little anxiety about it, which is the little T? Does that make sense?
That makes total sense, and you're actually bringing up a point that is very important to highlight. in terms of understanding PTSD and how we all respond to trauma. The fact is, and I'll get really personally back to you in a second, but the fact is that up to 70% of all adults in the United States will experience a big T trauma. Only up to 20% end up with post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's not a given that just because we have a major trauma, we have any post-traumatic effects that are significant and distorting for the rest of our lives. Most people, and you sound like you may be one of them, end up understanding and moving forward. So it would make anybody a little uncomfortable to come back into the house for the first time and get settled and get used to it all. And yet you sound wholly able and capable of remaining functional, having it all in perspective. While the trauma itself would still be defined as big T trauma, you have obviously processed it, integrated it, and while there's a little bit of normal discomfort, you are still completely functional. And so in that sense, you're just an example of how absolutely possible it is to experience a trauma like that and be able to move through it and remain moving forward on a path that's healthy and whole and really quite absolutely normal in the little discomfort you're having now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And I think my only savior is the fact that I was court ordered to therapy from 13 to 18, and I had some really good therapists along the way, you know. Mm. So I think that made me just, I don't know, maybe progress through things a little bit better. Not to say that I don't have major issues now, but I'm still dealing with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, the good news is that you're dealing with it at a very good level, and that's great, because I didn't have that kind of support when I was 13 to 18. You know, 13 to 18 is when we develop our whole identity. So you had great direction in learning who you were and incorporating that experience into the larger idea of who you are, so it didn't start to define you. And now, whatever you're still feeling that's hanging around, there are a slew of different ways to process that out. Whether we have big T trauma or little T trauma, the recovery process is very similar, and the modalities that work for one work for the other. So there are a significant number of opportunities for you to sort of get rid of anything you feel is still bothering you.
Okay.
Well, that gets to my next question, and where we can maybe you can go into more detail about that. We actually have more questions from callers in, but I would like to get to this next question. I think it's a good segue. What did you find were the three most useful tools you developed to help you not be a victim forever? What did you use? I know you talked about in the part that I read so far, dancing and meditation and hypnosis, but what helped you go from being in such a state of hyperarousal and avoidance and re-experiencing to any sense of mastery over this where it was not running your life?
First of all, I think it's a process. And second of all, everything that I'm about to say, because we only have a limited amount of time, and I understand that. So if anyone wants deeper insight into all of this, the HealMyPTSD.com website, everything we're talking about tonight is more in-depth on that site even, and we have an education and a treatment tab that will give even more information. And Susan, you know, the funny thing is that I did not have my PTSD diagnosis until my late 30s. So I went from 18 till about 37, 13 to 37, really confused about my own behavior, very avoidant of it, very in denial. You know, if anybody suggested that I needed help, I told them, you're the problem. I'm completely fine. I don't know what's wrong with you, but you should go see a therapist. So it took me a long time to actually get into therapy, and then a series of years in different modalities. And I think that everything we do, whether it brings you to freedom or not, whether you can see the benefits or not, actually is like putting money in your healing bank. So as I answer your question, I want to qualify it by saying that I did have modalities that I felt were most helpful to me, and we're all individual, so we all have to figure out what those modalities are. There's a big sort of pinata of different options. But I do think that even while we're on that process, I use some modalities that really made me feel much worse, and while it made me miserable at the time, I do recognize that the insights that maybe they brought me to, I could only get to that way. So moving into my recovery was an interesting process for me, because it required me to finally step up and take responsibility for it. I'd been sitting in a therapist's office for years, talking and talking and talking and getting worse and worse and worse, and really waiting for him to heal me. You know, like I show up once a week. I'm so amazed, Susan, and maybe the people you work with do this too. My clients are so proactive in between our meetings. They do so much work. And I never did any work. I showed up, I did my weekly hour, and then I went back into my PTSD fog. So when I really became engaged in recovery, it was because I was just wasting away. My body had all kinds of medical problems, and my mind was just imploding, and I thought something's got to change here. And that was when I started to really research what is trauma, what is trauma recovery about, what are the theories of how we get this done. And that was when I started to begin thinking out of the box. And you mentioned some of the things that really helped me. I learned to meditate, which within weeks really cut down my anxiety level. You know, I just started meditating for a whole hour every day, sometimes twice a day, because it was helping me get a focus and come down from the ceiling, which is pretty much where I lived. And so that was very helpful. And then towards the end of my recovery, when things were just going so poorly, I thought, I'm just going to do something crazy. I'm going to try hypnosis, because I heard an ad on the radio that hypnosis could end a nicotine addiction. And in my experience, PTSD is two things, an identity crisis and a trauma addiction. And I thought, I'm going to go to hypnosis and get them to stop this trauma addiction. And it was a Hail Mary kind of thing. I didn't think it would work. I didn't believe in it. I didn't think I could be hypnotized, because when you're really hypervigilant, you think that there's no way that you could possibly relax. But I just decided I'm going to try it, and it was an amazing and profound experience for me. And I added to that the idea, I need to feel a little bit good every day. I cannot live in this despair and this blackness and this enormously heavy depression all the time. And I decided I just need to feel good a little bit every day, and the only way that I ever felt good was when I danced. So I decided to start, I signed up for a dance class every day of the week. It didn't even matter what the class was to me. I just needed to get out of my head. And we know now from research and the studies of the science of the brain and neuroplasticity how profound an impact positive experiences can have on rewiring the brain. I didn't know any of that 10 years ago, but we know now what a great benefit that has. And for me, it gave me a whole new way to start seeing the possibility of who I could become, this woman who actually could feel good, this woman who could be present. I dissociated a lot, usually, because my body was a terrifying place for me to be. But through dance, I learned to be present and in the moment and in my body in that present moment. And all of these things started to make me realize there's an authentic me down in there. And if I can just access her and pull up that courage with all of these different things that I'm doing, I might be able to get this done. And in fact, that was the case.
Well, it sounds like the dancing really pulled you into a vision about possibilities, about your joyful self, that it was you were not only addressing the problems and the issues and the dilemmas around it, but it created a kind of bridge toward a future more joyful in the moment self, which sounds like that was really significant. You also brought up something I found very interesting. You said that the hypnosis helped you deal with the trauma addiction. And it's interesting because I have seen a lot of people, and I know a lot of therapists who work with trauma victims who seem so bonded to the trauma. And if you even, even to suggest it in any way feels so insulting or outrageous to them, but they are so defined by it that it is kind of like a bonding to the trauma as a new identity. And it sounds like what you're saying is you began to forge a new identity that wasn't just defined by the trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it makes sense. You know, for so many reasons, we become defined by our experiences, both good and bad. And I think with trauma, most of the change that defines us in our lives is change we choose. You know, I choose to go to this college. I choose to become, you know, this professional. And I choose to marry this person. I choose to not marry. You know, I choose to have a baby. The big things that define us, we usually choose. Trauma eliminates the element of choice. And you
yes.
are defined by what happens when that is the case.
Yes.
And then I think it's a real awakening. Holy cow, I'm not always safe. I'm not always in control. I better become more aware. I better really, really know what it means to live in this danger so I see it coming the next time, so I can stop it the next time, so I'm not so surprised the next time, so this doesn't hurt so much the next time. It becomes safer to live in the trauma than
yes.
in any other way.
Well, it's an illusion of control that if I'm hypervigilant, if I'm always on the lookout, that maybe I can beat it to the past if something's coming down the pike, that maybe I'll be in control. Now, Michelle, we have somebody else who's been very patiently waiting with another question. Would you like to take it?
Absolutely.
Okay. Hello? Wait, let me make sure this. Hello, caller. You have a 917 area code. Would you like to say your name and share your question or your comment?
Yes. Hello, Susan. My name is Andrea, and I have a question for your guest speaker, Michelle. Michelle, first of all, I find your story very compelling, and thank you for being brave to share that with all of us.
Thank you.
When I think of trauma, I think of an event or something that has impacted intensely the psyche. And then I also think of trauma to the body, a horrific accident, something where you lose a limb or something really, really horrific that creates these horrible images in your mind. And I'm sure they're both very difficult to work through, but I was wondering while you were speaking, thinking of this, if there is one kind of trauma, or trauma is trauma, the emotional versus the physical trauma to the body, which is more difficult to get past and work through, or if they both have the same impact.
That's a great question, and I think that it really comes down to the person. We're all so individual in our trauma, very universal in our post-trauma experience, and very individual in our recovery. And what first comes to mind when you say that is the mind-body connection is so powerful. So if you hurt my body, that's going to impact my mind. And I certainly have worked with a lot of clients who their traumas are first and foremost, like mine was, physical. But then you work with people whose trauma was first and foremost emotional, and we know that the mind impacts the body. Just for example, the mind is capable of producing 50% more stress than the body can handle. Every thought you have produces a physical reaction. So I find it really difficult to separate them out because there's such a feedback loop between the mind and the body. And I think then that in recovery, it really comes down to what do you resonate with. There are great trauma recovery processes that are body-centric, like somatic experiencing and tension and trauma releasing exercises. And that will have an effect on your mind. So even if you have a trauma that's mostly mostly emotional, you could do these physical modalities and see enormous change in your mind. Conversely, for me, my trauma was physical, but the things that brought me the most relief were things that were in my mind, hypnosis and neuro-linguistic programming. And then, of course, I added the dance, but I'm talking about really trauma recovery work modalities. They were mind and emotional centered, and yet they had an enormous impact on my body. All of the undiagnosable medical mystery problems. I mean, they thought I had liver cancer and celiac disease and mercury poisoning because they just couldn't figure out what was wrong with my body. But I used all of these emotional and intellectual or mind-oriented properties for recovery. And here's the amazing thing. My body spontaneously healed itself. Every problem that it had is gone. So I think you're bringing up a great question, and yet I think the answer is individual to each person. Does that answer what you were asking?
Completely. Thank you. Yes, it's very, very interesting. It really is. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
Michelle, I'm wondering if you could comment about the use of EMDR, eye movement, deprocessing, desensitization and reprocessing. I have personally seen some what look like really miraculous changes in people who, and it's often in my realm because I work primarily with couples, around the discovery of an affair or sudden death of a loved one, but mostly around betrayals, infidelities in relationships, and where the person who discovers it is so traumatized they literally cannot get through the day. They're crying all day, they can't function, or they can't get out of bed. They live in their reptilian brain, and they cannot calm themselves down. And I have seen, where traditional talk therapy or traditional kinds of techniques just would not access anything that was language-based, wouldn't seem to access any kind of relief, where when they do begin to do EMDR, it begins to calm all systems down. And I'm wondering if EMDR was part of your repertoire, and if not, what your thought is about it.
Yes, it was a part of my repertoire, and I did not have much success with it. And this gets back to that we're also individual, because I know some people who have amazing results with it. So for me, it really just threw me off a cliff, and I would be totally more dysfunctional after every session than I was going into it. This is also several years ago, before they really revamped EMDR as a process. So
Michelle, by the way, I don't know if you're further from your mic. You're breaking up a little. Are you on a cell phone or a landline?
No, I'm on a landline, and I haven't moved. I've been standing in the same place.
Maybe
it's the weather.
It might be. Keep talking.
Okay. Anyway, well, here's the thing. So it didn't work for me, but that is irrelevant because we're also individual. On my radio show, Your Life After Trauma, I interviewed Dr. Francine Shapiro around this time last year about EMDR, and it is a fantastic interview that really explains how and why it works and showcases and highlights the process and where it's grown to today. And I think it's a great thing to do. I love all of, Dr. Shapiro doesn't like it to be called an alternative process because it's clinically been researched now. But to me, talk therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, those are, traditional talk therapy are the traditional things. And to me, EMDR was really out of the box when I was introduced to it, like the energy processing therapies, like tapping and things like that. And so I think it's an enormously valid thing to try. And that's really all we can do in recovery is you just keep trying. I used 10 modalities to get to complete freedom. And partly there are some modalities you use that they just don't feel good to you, and EMDR just physically didn't feel good to me. And so that, I'm sure, got in the way of how it worked for me. And then there are other times that you're using a modality that may feel good to you, but you're just not ready for the work that has to be done. There's a huge amount of fear involved in the recovery process, which is just one of the many PTSD ironies. You can't stand the way you're living, and the thought of changing is terrifying. So you can use a process and be so resistant to the idea of change because you're afraid that the process doesn't work. Well, that doesn't mean the process was useless. It just means you weren't ready. So there are a lot of variables when we try these things, but I think EMDR is a great thing to try.
Okay, but it sounds like what you're saying is that people need to recognize, anyone who's been through trauma needs to recognize that it's not like there's a one-size-fits-all. It's very mm-hmm. individualized, and to see it as a kind of unfolding creative process, that you try one thing, it works. If not, you try something else, that people respond in different ways at different times to different modalities.
That's such a great summary, Susan. Absolutely. I think one of the most frustrating things is that, you know, if we all have bronchitis and you're not allergic to penicillin, pretty much we can all take penicillin, and in 48, 72 hours, we start to feel better. And with post-traumatic stress disorder, it's not like that at all. You are completely unique. There is no prescription. No one knows how long it's going to take. No one knows what the combination is that's going to bring you to freedom. So it's really up to you to persevere, to have the courage to keep trying, and above all, to have the hope and the belief that it's possible. And that is really all I clung to a lot of the time, just the hope and that there was something better for me, and the belief that I had the strength and the courage to keep going until I got there. And I think that's what trauma teaches us. We have this enormous power that we utilize during our trauma to move through and survive it. And then I think so often we forget to use that same power afterward and in recovery. And it's really a matter of embracing that power and learning to use it in a good way that can add so much to the recovery process as you discover who you're going to be now and then
right.
who you choose to be later.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it feels, you're saying it feels, it's really important to stay connected to your hope. I've worked with a number of clients who, after trauma, they are so vigilant and they try so hard to maintain control over everything. And essentially what they're seeking is some sense of certainty about the world in the aftermath of trauma. And then part of the work, I know, and I'm not a trauma specialist, but, you know, one of the things I've discovered is that part of the work is helping people live with the certainty of uncertainty in life, that mm-hmm. it's an inherent part of life, and how do you live with that and yet not live as a victim? And it certainly sounds like things that connect you to the goodness of life, even though it holds inherent uncertainty, is really critical, absolutely critical.
I couldn't agree more. And I think there's a big job to be done after trauma. There's a big disconnection between what you thought the world was like and what it actually can be like, and who you thought you were and who you are now, because your core essential self, I believe, still exists. It's just now there's also all this other stuff that comes along because of trauma. And then it's a matter of discovering, who am I going to be because of this? Am I going to be a survivor who only defines herself by the past? Or am I going to be the kind of person that recognizes that happened? How lucky am I that I made it through? And how am I going to make my life meaningful and worthwhile now? And what do I want that to look like? And really, I think what we're talking about, Susan, is getting back to that idea of choice, you know? What is going to define me? Who do I want to be? And how am I going to create that self is a huge part of the post-trauma and PTSD experience.
Yes, that you may not have had a choice about having the trauma inflicted on you, but you do have choices about how are you going to respond to it and how you are going to move forward with some sense of goodness about life and yourself and the world. Now, Michelle, I'm aware that we're amazingly running out of time. I'd like to get to the next question, which is really a central part of our program, and that is, what would you see, and you can speak from your own personal experience, but and also in a more general way, what do you see as the role for a supportive spouse, partner, or close family member? How would you see them as ideally helping, and where would you see the limits and boundaries of that?
This reminds me of, I wrote many years ago, 10 tips for understanding someone with PTSD. And it grew out of the thought that I had, there were things I wish my family had understood so that they could have helped me better, number one, and number two, not been so pained by the experience of watching me go through this and having to deal with me while I did. So I think that the first thing is that education is key. If you're supporting or living with someone or just even being a friend to somebody who's been through a major trauma, the first thing to understand is what it means to be traumatized and how somebody can change in response to the effect of that. And so I think the first line of really being in a relationship, however you would define that, with someone with a post-traumatic issue, is by understanding what it means to have trauma and what changes that brings. And then I think it comes to learning the person and giving them the room that they need to sort of flail around, because a lot of the recovery process, we don't know what we're doing. And a lot of the coping process, we're overwhelmed. So we do have aberrant behavior, and I think as someone on the outside looking in, to understand it's not all about you. It's not, if I'm being unkind or irrational or really awful, I may be taking it out on you, and I may be saying the problem is you, but it doesn't mean that you are facilitating this necessarily or really are the problem at all.
And to not personalize it, to try not to personalize.
Yes, that's the great word, is not to always personalize it. Sometimes, you know, my mom laughs because she says I was 16 and she changed the carpet in the living room of the house where we lived, and I went ballistic. And honestly, Susan, I don't even remember this, but she says I was just hysterical over that she had changed the carpet. And she said the amount of rage that I just spewed on her over the changed carpet was, she just stood there. She didn't know what to do with it, because why would anybody be angry about that she changed the carpet?
Right.
And that's the kind of ridiculous, irrational stuff we do. But to me and to many trauma survivors, I need everything to stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
Change is frightening, even if it's just a carpet. You know, it's evidence that things are not under my control. So I think you're right.
To understand, but you're saying to if you get a lay of the land and you educate yourself about what trauma is, you might have a better understanding of the kinds of things that could be very triggering.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I wonder about, would you encourage a trauma victim to talk to their spouse or partner, to educate the spouse or partner about what they know their triggers are? And
oh, definitely.
To pull them into, this is what happens to me. I may not have success with it yet, but I know this is a trigger for me, and you just need to be aware so that you're not in the way, and that ideally you can be part of the solution. Would you see that as overkill, or would that be
I think that's absolutely great. I was just working with a mom whose daughter was traumatized, and we were talking about just this issue. She said, I know my daughter's triggers, and I'm trying to like make sure I make her breathe. The fact is, we have a whole toolkit of things. As trauma survivors, we know if I close my eyes, if I count to 10, if I chew on a piece of ice, if I stamp my feet, whatever it is, we know what our coping mechanisms are. And sometimes in the overwhelm of an intense emotion, we can forget. But another person can say, okay, hold on, stand still, stamp your feet, count to 10, that you can become the coach to that person and help them through that moment. And in that case, number one, give them the guidance that their chaos is taking away from them. And number two, give them the support of another being in a moment that's very frightening and isolating. So you can really be a partner more than ever. And in my own personal life, I've tried it both ways. I went the route at first not telling people I had an issue. And what happens then is you try to hide all of your issues, and you just want them to see you as being the most perfect thing on the planet. And then they don't understand what's wrong with you when you just can't hold it all together anymore. And I had much more success in my relationship when I just flat out from the beginning said, look, here's who I am. I have PTSD. It means I have insomnia. It means I have depression. It means I can fly off the handle sometimes. And I just need you to know about this going in so that you're not surprised later. And then you really find somebody who's willing to hear the truth and stick by you. And frankly, Susan, and you're a relationship coach, so you know this, the more honesty there is in a relationship, the stronger and more real it is and becomes. So I think it's good to be honest about it.
In my experience, it's also been helpful to build in the reality that the partner can experience secondary traumatization, that by being around the traumatized victim and kind of witnessing the meltdowns and all the symptoms around the trauma, that there can be a kind of compassion fatigue for the partner. The partner and I, you know, in my experience, it's helpful to kind of normalize the fact that your partner may not be unconditionally available 24/7. They have needs too, and they run out of steam, and all they can do is the best they can to help. But to kind of build that in.
Definitely, and we see that a lot in the military, secondary traumatization, because if you're sleeping next to somebody who in the middle of the night thinks he's being attacked and you're the attacker and he's, you know, got you by the throat in the bed, that does become a secondary trauma. And certainly compassion fatigue. I mean, the man that I've been with, my partner for years now, and he was with me through my whole recovery, and he's the one I was talking about. I just sat down and I said, look, this is it. And he understood when I wake up after a nightmare and I'm just all wound up and terrified, he knew just to hold me and put his hand on my forehead. And for whatever reason, that immediately calmed me down. And I can imagine that night after night, this would drive him crazy. But, you know, I think if you find the right person who has that kind of patience and also knows when to take time for himself, it's not like he took care of me 24/7. It's really important as a caregiver to maintain your own identity, your own time off, your own hobbies, your own pleasures and pursuits, so that you can refuel. If you're going to support somebody who's traumatized and a high care kind of situation, it's important for you to have downtime so that you have the energy to do that. And it is not selfish. It is self-important to take that time and to take care of yourself. Otherwise, you're both going to go down.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're bringing up an important point that if it's clear between the partners that the person who has been traumatized is the one primarily responsible for their recovery, and the other person can only help and help as they have the energy to help, but they need to kind of take your oxygen first. The partner needs to take their oxygen first. I've worked with couples where part of what happened around this was that the partner without the trauma was made to feel, and unfortunately by other therapists in the past, that if you were just more loving or if you were more unconditionally available or if you were this or that, that so much would be so much better. And then they were made to feel very guilty and very shamed about the whole thing. And it sounds like basically what you've done in your recovery is recognize that you are the captain of the ship. And there may be other people on board. Maybe at times they can help. I'm looking for a metaphor for sailing. I don't sail. You know, they can help with the the sails or this or that, but maybe steer for a while, but you're the captain of that ship.
That, I think that's such a great point and an important one to get to as we get to the end of the show, Susan, because that's the main message, really. Nobody can heal you except you. I mean, that's the years that I spent in therapy waiting for my therapist to work some kind of magic was, you know, necessary for me at the time, but not the most effective recovery process.
Right,
and
right.
Waiting for your partner to get it done, or if they would only give you more love, is ridiculous, because recovery isn't about feeling loved. It's certainly that's a wonderful thing, and we all need that, but that does not do the work of recovery. Only you can do the work of recovery, and you have to commit to it.
Well, and that gets to one of my final questions for you, and I'm sure you hear this all the time. Do you feel it's possible to fully overcome the effects of trauma? In other words, is there hope for a, quote, normal life after big T trauma where you're not triggered with any regularity, you may not have nightmares or flashbacks, where you feel like you're living a kind of normal life and you don't feel like you're run by it?
Absolutely, and this is the beauty of my book. Before the World Intruded begins with my trauma, moves through my PTSD years, and then moves through my recovery. And by the end of the book, you see this whole case study, really, of how recovery can happen and how free a person can become. I am and have been for years 100% free of any PTSD symptom, and I have been in triggering situations and been shocked by how okay I am, which just underscores for me every time, holy cow, I really did it. And I'm not the only one, Susan. I mean, it's not like I'm special or unique. There are thousands of us. I have colleagues who are trauma survivors and PTSD survivors who are in the same place I am now. And I've worked with clients who have been highly medicated on 3 different medications and years of struggling and being told by therapists, you just have to learn to live this way. We'll just keep medicating you. You need to just cope. There's no hope for anything better than that. And that's flat out ridiculous. I work with people, they end up off their medications, they go back to living their lives without all of the PTSD symptoms. So we see this in the healing industry all the time. So yes, emphatically, passionately, it is 100% possible to overcome and not just go on and have a normal life, but have an extraordinary life.
That's a really wonderful point, and we could probably have another whole show, Michelle, about how so many industries have thrived on maintaining the sense of trauma as a life predicament. That there's probably more about, you know, whose car you're funding, whose kids' college education you're funding by maintaining a sense of victimhood around this. And I think it's wonderful that you can speak very directly, and you had direct experience with so many people who they're not coping. They've recovered, and they have a happy life, a meaningful life. Now, I'm wondering, Michelle, and we actually only have 3 minutes left. These programs go really fast. It's just amazing. I've tried talking faster and faster, but it doesn't seem to work. I'm wondering, can you share with how people can get your book?
Oh, absolutely. You can get the book on my website, yourlifeaftertrauma.com. The book is called Before the World Intruded. It's also available on Amazon and Kindle, and you can go to your bookstore.
Okay. That's terrific. So they might be able to find it also in a Barnes & Noble?
Absolutely, and if they don't have it, they'll order it for you.
Okay, that's wonderful.
Go in and tell them, we need this book.
Okay, and it sounded like people can contact you if they wanted to work with you directly, or they just wanted more information and resources about this subject, and you're a wealth of information. They would go to healmyptsd.com.
Absolutely. You can also access my radio show from there, Your Life After Trauma. There's a button right on the homepage And every week we talk about exactly these kind of issues and what it means to overcome. I interview the top experts in the field, so we've got a wealth of information, and all of the archives are free. So that's over 100 different practitioners and professionals in the field weighing in on exactly what you asked me. Is it possible to overcome this? And they all say yes, every single one of them. No matter what modality they work in, everybody agrees it is entirely possible.
Well, that is such a wonderful, hopeful, just expansive message. I'm so glad you were on the program, Michelle. Thank you so much for all your insights and inspiration. I know I've learned a lot, and I hope our listeners have gained as much from the show as I have in a short, less than an hour. So I want to thank you, and maybe we'll do a subsequent show about something, you know, taking one more of these issues a little bit more in depth. But thanks again, Michelle. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Susan. Have a great evening.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Take care. And thank you to all you listeners and callers. Thank you to you for you callers for your thoughtful questions and comments. I wanted to just let you know that my next Blog Talk Radio episode is on Wednesday, March 23rd at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I'll be announcing the topic and the possible guest soon once I decide. In the meantime, there's a little headline here. If you have any questions or curiosity about how to manage yourself better in any relationship, go to Amazon.com and type in Susan Lager for a copy of my new workbook, Become Relationship Smart Without a Lifetime of Therapy. It's what I feel is a gold mine of tools and insights about how to have happier, more productive relationships of all kinds. It's the second in the Couple Speak series of books now available to use and enjoy. So you can find it on Amazon, and I hope you enjoy it. Anyway, gotta go. I hope you all enjoy the show, and I'll see you next month on the 23rd at 8:30 p.m. Take care. Bye-bye.